This is Cave Scott Allen of odeco.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello, hooray, welcome. It is March 7, 2019. We are continuing with our straight-to-video format where we just record and publish and don't agonize about editing. And
or who's in attendance.
Or who's, hey, who's on the call?
Well, this is Scott, and I made it.
Well done. Well done, sir. And Kevin's there, too?
Yeah, I am. Are we just redoing our intro? Ray? But this is Kevin.
I'll sing some drums. That's wonderful. Yeah. I don't know if Scott Kuhn will make it. And then we invited Rob Connery, and Rob replied, "I am too busy planning build, and now this is just a strange, like, bizarro world where I picture Rob with, like, does this mean he has a goatee or doesn't have a goatee? I don't know what's happening." So, wonderful.
It explains why you're free, because usually it's John saying, "Sorry, it's builds in 6 months. I'm buried."
So I'm on a different team. Yeah,
you don't do any build stuff anymore.
Not really. No. Yeah, the team I was on before was like put on build. They shuffle things around. The team I was on was DX, which before that was I don't even know. It was like a developer evangelism group, and now I'm part of the .NET community team. So I'm inside the .NET group. So it's kind of like a weird shuffle of things. Before I was a .NET specialist in the evangelism group, and now I'm a kind of an evangelist sort of person inside the .NET group. I don't know if that matters to anybody else but me, but I don't have really anything to do with build anymore. So I get to go to it, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
And I did see that. I saw the cool announcement that they're letting people take they're kids, but, you know, they're not being nice about it. They can take like a younger person for free. I don't know the exact terms of that, but that sounds kind of cool.
It's pretty interesting to me. I think it's anyone, what is like 14 to 17 or something like that. It's basically like that kind of kid sort of age. It's just too old. My nerd daughter is 11, so I don't know if I can get an exception. But your daughter's famous. Yeah, although she's gotten distracted lately. She wanted a pet. Very short story here. She wanted a pet. We said, fine, you can have hermit crabs and fish. Well, she killed a few fish, and we've got hermit crabs, but they don't really do anything. They kind of crawl around. So then she really campaigned hard for a cat this Christmas, and my wife like put her foot down, no cats, and I was kind of like, So somehow we ended up saying, okay, a guinea pig is fine. You can get one guinea pig. So then she gets a guinea pig. Then my wife like turns into a total softie and is like, oh, it looks lonely. It needs a friend. And they both, my daughter and my wife, are reading that guinea pigs are pack animals. So we get a second guinea pig. They're both females. We're very sure of this. But however, one of the guinea pigs that we got was pregnant when we got her. So then she gives birth and we now had six guinea pigs. And so then we ended up putting two up for adoption. I don't even know how I got into talking about that. Oh, my daughter is like totally distracted by guinea pigs now. And she has like an Instagram with 100 plus followers. And she posts all these videos about guinea pigs now. So maybe she doesn't care about build. Wow. Back on to build.
That's not nearly as lucrative a career path.
You know, you'd be surprised. There are people that are way into guinea pigs in a way I would have never, ever thought. So... Yeah. Yeah. So build coming up, that is, I think that is neat. I think partly the deal with that. So Tibby, who helps put on DevSum, and he's over in, I forget where he lives now. He moves around a lot. But he brought his two daughters to build last year, and that may have had to do with it. Like, I think they got to meet Satya or something like that. And people are like, this is awesome. We should do this more. That's my guess of what happened. So
gotta get him young. Start indoctrinating him early.
You know, I feel like there is definitely a thing with that. Like Microsoft stupidly ignored education at a time where Apple didn't, and it's had huge effects because people are comfortable with the brand and all that kind of stuff. But it's also like it it feels like bringing younger people or different people into a group is good for everybody too. And so like, hey, we probably could use some young perspectives, you know, in the .NET and the Microsoft world and all that. So,
oh, no doubt the .NET ecosystem could use an infusion of younger people.
Yeah, well, so I guess segue sort of. That's something I've been focusing on lately with the .NET Foundation board elections. We kicked that off starting. So we announced membership in December. It took a while to set up all the moving parts and the membership and election, like actual process and policy and all that boring stuff that's important. So we actually started a month-long election February 28th. And it's like 3 weeks of campaigning and then 1 week of online voting.
And if elected, what do you get to do? Do you get to carry a scepter or anything like that?
Why not? Yeah, we're making the rules. I feel like that is something that the board could self-appoint scepterhood. Yeah, I mean, so the idea is .NET Foundation is it's a nonprofit. It is external to Microsoft. Microsoft has supported it over the years, like donating people's time and donating money, but it is separate. And part of what's going on here is like actually having a community elected board that is clearly external to Microsoft. So Microsoft, we have some anti-stacking rules in place, and that includes Microsoft. So no company can have more than two board members. There's a total of seven board members. So no matter how, the most we could have is two, we will likely only have one. And that's fine, you know. So like this will make it very clear what's going on. And then as far as what the board does, like we have a budget, we have this new corporate sponsor program. So we're, you know, we're not like rolling in dough like Linux Foundation or something, but we do have, you know, we'll have a few hundred thousand dollars to spend, and they can kind of decide on what projects to support, how to support them, how to, you know, how to involve more people. How to work with meetups. We have 250 meetups now around the world, and how many countries? 52 or 53 countries. So,
oh wow.
Yeah. So there's, it's kind of like the idea of .NET Foundation is to make .NET more than Microsoft. Like, of course, Microsoft supports it, but it could and should be a lot more than Microsoft as like a real open source thing, right?
So, what other companies are on the board? Right.
Yeah. So that's an interesting thing. We have a very clear distinction between companies and board membership. So we have a technical steering group that includes like Google, Samsung, Red Hat, JetBrains. I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple, and they'll Unity and Microsoft. We also have a corporate. So a lot of those got involved because they're like actually shipping .NET in some way. Or, you know, building a product that deeply relies on .NET. Over time, though, we realized we had some people talk to us and be like, hey, we're an ISV, we're a vendor, we care about, we want to support .NET, but how do we fit in with like a technical steering group? And so we changed it to also add on a corporate sponsor program. And so corporate sponsors are more kind of like sponsor, they care about the community, but they're not like, they're more interested kind of in a business and community perspective and not in a technical perspective. So anyhow, we announced Telerik and Progress and Insight were three companies that joined as our kind of initial corporate sponsors in December. And then we're going to be adding some more on. I'm talking to several. But all of those, like, because of that, they can, like, we have an advisory council that doesn't have any voting rights, but we meet regularly and kind of, you know, talk about stuff. But as far as the actual board, there's no kind of like, oh, you join as a company, you get a board seat. That was something, you know, we talked about quite a bit. There's really different models for that. And that was something I really appreciate, like working with Miguel de Acasa on this. Like, how awesome is that to be able to like plan something out with Miguel? And he was like, there's different models. GNOME Foundation does this, you know, and so we like took this hard stance of, the board is completely community elected. So people can join the .NET Foundation by, you know, showing that there's a pretty lightweight application process where you say like, you know, have you contributed? Have you contributed to docs? Do you speak? You know, basically like, are you part of the community even a little bit? And we're very, very lenient on that. We've accepted people that have contributed, you know, a paragraph to docs. And so then all those people are voting members, and then any voting member can run in the election. So, yeah. And then it's just totally community elected. So there's no like, pay to play sort of thing.
Cool.
Yeah,
very good.
Yeah. So, and then as part of that, I've been doing this stuff, kind of, how do we actually like run a campaign? How do you make a website where people can give their campaign statements and stuff? So I've been like, set that up using Google Pages, and had to like, learn stuff about Jekyll I'd never learned before. And so that's fun. So the actual, like, for people to announce they're running in the election is they submit an issue that has some markdown, and it gets dropped in a folder, and then that automatically gets built out as part of the GitHub Pages thing. So a lot of like interesting automation things as part of this too.
Yeah, we have to dig into that. So like, first of all, why Google Pages? What's
Yeah, well,
compelling about that?
Yeah, so I mean, my kind of stronger dev suit is in ASP.NET Core and stuff, and that is also a possibility to do something like that. But it really was kind of compelling to be like, number one, anybody can submit an edit, you know, just by pull request to some markdown, and it's automatically getting built out. And then just kind of I really liked the flow of it's just very lightweight. Like I didn't want to be a bottleneck and slowing things down in the campaign system, you know, where somebody's like something.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So you said Google Pages, mm-hmm. You mean GitHub Pages?
Sorry. Oh my gosh. Okay. Now I have to edit this.
I thought this was some product reveal that I missed.
Okay. Oh man, now I've got to go back and edit. No, yeah. Everywhere that I said Google Pages, yeah. I mean GitHub Pages. That's so funny. I don't even Yeah, so it's all GitHub Pages.
That
Sorry.
Makes a little more sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I pictured the board meeting on Google Plus.
Right. And, you know, it's Wave these awesome. Days. We're on Wave.
Oh right.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry. So hopefully it makes more sense as GitHub Pages. Yeah, and then just Jekyll, standard Jekyll stuff. And there's some neat things that Jekyll does that probably a lot of people are like, duh, John, that's how it's always been. And how could you not know that? But like Jekyll collections are pretty interesting. So everything that's in this folder, all these markdown files, they have like a couple of lines at the top that have like the person's name and some stuff. And then there's like a two or three lines in your config for the GitHub Pages, and it like automatically understands everything in this folder is like part of a collection. And then you can iterate over it, and you can like, you know, like you get all the information that's in the front matter is available as parameters and stuff. So, yeah. So, I mean, it kind of makes sense because people build out blogs with these or build out documentation. You'd have to be able to have like dynamic content that way. But it was interesting kind of seeing like how it's implemented. And then I guess the other interesting thing for me is I've messed with Jekyll before tiny bits on Windows, and it was painful because it's the whole Ruby stack, and Ruby's great and Windows is great, but the two are not great together. but doing this using WSL was like super easy. It's just apt-get stuff. Oh, nice. And it's like totally worked. Good. Yeah, so I just followed basically the like installing on Ubuntu like steps, and it just worked. And then there were some like scary lines before where it was like they would say don't access your Linux files from Windows, or don't access your Windows files from Linux. I don't know. I just know it was scary, and I'd always forget. But they've actually like fixed that a lot now. So inside the prompt in Ubuntu, I could just say like code dot, and it would pop up Visual Studio Code in that directory, and I'd just edit stuff, and then Jekyll would pick it up and refresh, and it like just was magic. So,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So it actually all kind of works. So I've built out a few sites using that recently, the election site and then a presentation site.
Here's my quick WSL success story. So the older child is taking some programming courses at a college, specifically in C++, which I haven't touched in years. But of course, when he comes to me and says, hey, how do you do such and such a thing in C++?
It's kind of like, just say, don't.
Yeah, I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I'm going to have to write a little bit of code to make sure what I'm telling him isn't completely off base. I don't want to install the C++ compiler for Visual Studio because that just is like gigabytes and gigabytes of stuff that just,
yeah,
it's stuff and it's always there. But man, with WSL, I could just install the GCC package and I'm writing C++ with Visual Studio Code in a matter of like 2 minutes, and it's awesome.
Yeah. I've been pretty happy with it. It's one of those things where you're like, this can't work, you know? And then they actually made it work pretty darn well. And I like, over time, people are like, okay, it works here, but it sucks for this kind of dev. But it's like, to me, that was a true test. If I can build on a Ruby stack and it all works, then it's like, I'm convinced. So, and there are some things I know that there are things in the Linux world where file access is important, like file speed. Creating a new file is like nothing in Linux, and it's more of a commitment on Windows, I guess. So like, yeah, that is one thing where it is slower to create. Like if you want to create 1,000 files, you know,
or an npm install.
Exactly, those are synonymous, right? So so that it is still slower on Windows, but it's gotten to a like pretty manageable. I don't know if I'd want to do full-time node dev on WSL, but but for my kind of small, build a small website.
And is that an issue with WSL, or is that like an issue with like the Windows file system?
I think it's the Windows file system. So like so WSL, WSL is like a layer on top of Windows, and it does optimize a bunch of stuff, but it's still like, just writing files on Windows, there's more to it.
So does that mean just doing node development on Windows in general is not super fun? I mean, WSL aside.
Well, yeah. I mean, so like, for instance, Node came from a like Mac and Linux background, and then people got it working on Windows. And so just the like, you know, like everything's a file, and files are cheap on Linux and Mac kind of mentality meant that, like, that's part of why Node is so like, just throw a bunch of files out there, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you built the same thing on Windows, you would not do that. You would do something else because it would be slow and painful. So yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I like, I'm not a Node dev. It works on Windows, but it is, my understanding it is slower, but for this case, it's a few dozen files, you know, for GitHub pages, so it wasn't really an issue. I've seen some people write posts about like, that's it, I moved everything over to WSL, totally living the dream. I've seen some other people go like, hey, this isn't working for me because the file write is too slow for big, you know, node dependencies. And then the people will jump in and say, we're working on it. So that's about all I know.
Well, I could see that. I mean, for me, node development was always frustrating on Windows because it did feel a lot slower than on my MacBook.
It's funny because when I first got interested in node years and years and years ago, you know, this is before NPM even, one of the things I liked about it was that they made an early commitment to support Windows. And I was a Windows developer back then, right? Whereas like trying to do Ruby development on Windows was a total fail and still is apparently. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, yes, we're going to embrace and support Windows, you know, as a peer platform. But then I never actually ended up doing any real node development on on Windows because I got a Mac and never looked back. So,
yeah. My experience with that, there were two, like, Node by itself worked okay on Windows, but the two things you ran into, one was the like just performance wasn't great on Windows. And then the other was like Node itself was fine, but the packages were always built assuming they were running on a Mac. Yep. So they always assumed you're.
That's still an issue.
And I still, to this day, I still don't understand how we took a JavaScript based platform and made it depend on Python and C++ compilers. Like, but like Node.jip is like in use. Is that what it's called? NPM JIP? I forget what it is. No, it's,
yeah, the GYP.
Yeah. So it's like that depends on C++, and it depends on a specific C++ being in a specific path and all that. And it's like an environment variables. And like on a Mac, people don't think about it because it's just that's where it is. But for everybody like on Windows, it's like, well, I've got Visual Studio and I've got, you know, like whatever. And so, but then after time, they actually did create a thing with an installer that installed all the things, set all the environment variables and stuff. And it does kind of work. But by that point, I was like, I don't know. By that point, actually, for me personally, .NET Core was cross-platform and, you know, I know .NET and I was kind of like, I don't really need to do Node anymore. And that's where I was. So.
Yeah, I would run into funny situations with that back in the early days of Azure App Services when there was only Windows-based app services, but they officially supported Node. But I quickly found out that there was lots of packages you can get for Node that wouldn't work in that app services environment. Or wouldn't build properly or what have you. And it was always some of the strangest things. Like I could be using something that is just purely, should purely be HTTP based, like CouchDB or something. But here I am getting some package that's using C++ for something and getting these compiler errors. And I kind of gave up on it. I mean, it's much easier now that you can get a Linux based image for app services, but it was painful.
Yeah. Or use Docker or whatever. It's, but yeah, it just like I understand there's like a portability or a freedom or whatever, but I just never have understood why a C++ based any dependency made any sense there. Kevin, can you defend this?
Certain modules have native code, non JavaScript code in them, and so you gotta compile that somehow.
All right.
That seems to be less and less common though. At least in my, I'm not doing full-time development these days, but you know, it does seem like it's very specialized stuff where you have to write native code these days in the Node world.
There is native code side to it, but then there would be some where it's like, well, like GYP is just a, I don't even think that's necessarily for native code stuff. A lot of time it's just like, well, that's our build system. It's like, why are you building anything? You're JavaScript. I mean, I get it. I guess there's transpiling and blah, blah, blah.
No, a lot of people that were using that stuff for transpiling. But the other.
So what the hell?
So the other Windows pain point that I recall, again, I never actually did much Node development on Windows, but the other Windows pain point was bloody MaxPath. You know, and you get deep dependency trees, which again is better now. NPM, they did some major rework and it doesn't generate the.
So they did that there. And then also it's relatively solved problem on
Windows.
Is it?
Now. I was wondering about that actually.
So I never run into it anymore, like ever. I realized, so it was interesting because I cared about this stuff. Earlier on, I did care about Node and I cared about it. Like I would run into these sorts of problems, especially like earlier ASP.NET stuff had more like Node dependencies. And so I would run into, and so I was part of these email threads and I would be the jerk being like, what the hell, when are we fixing this and stuff? And for a long time, everybody's like, it's too hard. We'll never do it. Like, because everyone was waiting on someone else. And well, if we fix it from, you know, this API perspective, then Explorer won't be able to open the files. And so how can we create a file that Explorer can't open? But Explorer can't fix it because then they would break paint or whatever. You know what I mean? Everyone was like too scared. And finally, I forget who it was, but at a higher level sold this thing of like, we're going to make Windows a good platform for developers. And this is a like moonshot thing, but we're going to fix it. And so they did. And this guy, Jeremy Kuhn, who actually, I don't know if it's too late now, it might be interesting to get him on sometime. People just like dug in and like pushed it forward. And then they would be like, okay, if we're going to break you, sorry, but we're going to fix this. And then once that kind of got unblocked, then everyone was like, oh crap, now we got to deal with these MaxPath things. So I've just seen it kind of like it was treated. It stopped being treated as we can't do anything to, well, now we have these big files and we got to deal with it now. So, I can't remember the last time I've seen that error on Windows.
So when did that change? Like, when did that get fixed?
Correct me if I'm wrong, K-Sky. I think like a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, sounds about right.
Yeah, I would say about 2 years ago is when you would read a lot about how hard everyone had worked to get rid of this, and there were still a few edge cases, but yeah, I don't recall seeing any problems like that now for quite some time. I think I ran into a problem recently with a zip file, but that was probably more due to WinZip or something than Windows.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just quick Google searching here, and I'm seeing like 2016-ish. And part of it came from the like moving to Windows 10 with this kind of rapid release thing where it's like two you know, releases and it's just kind of pushed out. And so that was part of the thing too, is moving from the, well, we can't break anything because people don't update their operating system. You know, now it's like, hey, it's just part of life, you know? So, yeah. But it's funny because like the two things happened relatively at the same time, like Windows fixed Max Path, and also I'm not running on things that depend on those deep path limit, you know, don't have deeply nested paths anymore. But
here we go. Here's an interesting little tidbit here. Starting in Windows 10 version 1607, I don't know what that was exactly.
For creators.
Oh.
Max Path limitations have been removed from common Win32 file and directory functions. However, you must opt in to the new
behavior. Yeah, so that was another thing too, and I like pissed some people off arguing about that. I was like, don't make us opt in. And then like very senior people who had been at Microsoft working on these problems for a long time were like, shut up, little boy. But but they did slowly move it in via opt-in, and I believe now it's like automatic. There is also a thing in Windows as part of the control panel thing, and it's like saved as part of your profile. So once you do it once, I think it kind of sticks with you. But it's a like turn on developer mode. And I honestly haven't seen this for a bit, and so I'm not sure. But it was like, use developer features as part of the Windows settings. And it like turns on a few things. It like allows installing any app, which I don't know how much that matters, but there's some other things where it kind of like enables some developer sort of stuff. Yeah. So it's like use developer features, and it like makes it easier to turn on remote desktop and PowerShell and different things. Yeah, it's kind of funny. Some of the stuff, like I've sort of taken this for granted because it's not something I've run into for a bit, but that was so frustrating for a while. It's like making any of this stuff work on Windows was hard. So,
hey, speaking of old code, you know, Microsoft /calculator is now a repository on GitHub.
Crazy times.
Calc.exe is there. And what's so funny about this is, of course, I want to go to that repository and check it out. And you remember those early days of WPF and Silverlight, mm-hmm. where people were like, okay, let's write a demo app. And what we're going to do is we're going to build a calculator, and we're going to have a view model project. And you're thinking, oh yeah, you know, you're trying to be real world, but who built a calculator app? And then you go into this GitHub repository, and wouldn't you know, it's a calculator app, and it is using view models, and it's broken into multiple projects. And there's a build folder that has like four YAML files and this and that. And you're thinking, good grief, it's just a calculator. But it's,
you know, when I first saw this announced, I was like, oh, they took the calculator from like Windows NT and open sourced it, you know, like not the real thing, mm-hmm. that is really in Windows today. But no, it was not that.
Yeah, it's interesting. And to me, like, it's interesting the whole like it's XAML and C++. And so yeah. It's like I'll be looking at XAML, I'll be like, I kind of get this, and I'll look at C++. I'm like, why would you, you know? I don't know, maybe performance or whatever, but and then possibly like your team.
So in other words, the Windows, does the Windows team still like not believe in managed code? I mean, is that still?
Yeah, kind of. I think so. I mean,
still their position, so. Basically.
You know, I don't talk to them. They don't talk. No, I don't know. I feel like it's changed some over time. There's significant parts of like the store, and of course Visual Studio, and like there's significant parts that are .NET, you know, have .NET, and then having the dev platform be XAML. But yeah, I honestly, I don't know. Like, I don't see Windows source code like ever. So,
not until they open source it anyway.
I wonder if it'll change. I mean, I know in the beginning, 10 years ago, everyone on the Windows team, I'm sure, thought .NET was just horribly slow and bloated and this garbage collection is crazy. But now that things are a little, I mean, things are definitely different with .NET Core, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can stack Alex stuff and you have spans and you have more efficient everything. I wonder if anyone will ever come around and .NET some stuff.
Yeah, that stuff is really interesting to me. And some of this, like, hearing how it happened too is interesting, because a lot of this stuff with Span was some of the things that were in like Midori. And Midori as itself didn't get pushed forward, but a lot of like hearing later, like Joe Duffy and other people blogging and talking about this, it's like, hey, this was stuff we were doing on Midori and we brought these ideas over, you know? So like Span being able to access and manipulate chunks of memory without allocating, it's pretty cool. And then like, seeing how, like now with .NET Core 3, which I guess they just said is like Q3-ish timeframe, that now is able to, you can use that in WinForms and WPF. So like, you know, if there were arguments about performance for using .NET code, that kind of goes away some.
Okay, so I'm like totally not down with .NET Core. Does .NET Core support like full compilation? I don't know what the right term is here. Like, you know, compile down to a self-contained executable.
So that's a new thing too. That's part of .NET Core 3.
Okay.
It's So there's a linker, right? So that is something where they actually finally have that. They have. So it's interesting. I've been like doing this demo since build of last year. And there's actually a NuGet package that includes this linker. And so like little hello world WPF or WinForms, and then it's like 60 meg, which on the one hand is like, it's not tiny, but on the other hand is like, holy cow, this is every, you know, it's like you drop this on any computer, you know, on any Windows computer and it'll work. The one kind of thing there is people be like, oh, is this cross-platform? And the answer is no, because they're not like, WinForms and WPF still build on like Windows, you know, controls and, you know, the whole like Windows UI stack and DirectX and all those things. But yeah, you actually can do a self-contained exe finally. Mm. Yeah. So that's kind of a nice thing too. And that is a like selling point for .NET Core, right? Because in the past, .NET was like this monolithic install. It's one per machine and you update your .NET framework, you may break stuff. And so like systems administrators would say, we're not updating to this version of .NET because we have this old legacy app and blah, blah, blah. So now with this whole kind of self-contained side-by-side thing, you can have multiple .NET cores installed and it's like you can do folder-based versioning and all that.
That's definitely headed the right direction.
And the perf stuff is pretty fun for me to watch. Like both, so I help host the ASP.NET community stand up, and that's on Tuesdays. And this week we had David Fowler and Damian Edwards talking about performance stuff, and it's just like crazy stuff. Like when they first started doing Tech and Power, we're way down below Node and below everybody. We're like in PHP land, and we would do like 50,000 requests a second, and now they're doing like 7 million requests a second, and in the top 10 performing stacks, and a lot of it comes down to stuff like that span, and then also crazy stuff like platform intrinsics, so actually using like CPU instructions for like parsing and manipulating strings, and yeah,
it's amazing what Microsoft can do when they put their mind to it.
Right? It takes somebody like actually making it a thing. When you get something on a list of things people are tracking at Microsoft, like it gets better. Like it, and that was a thing where they have in the ASP.NET team room, they have like a big like dashboard, and it's red and it's green and it shows numbers. And if like somebody checks something in that slows down, you know, one of the scenarios they're tracking, it turns red and probably alarms go off and, you know, like, so, and so they actually are tracking it. And once they started like deeply tracking this stuff, then it like gets fixed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what happens with the Edge team, but you know.
Well, so one weird thing that's happening is moving to Chromium, right?
Yeah, there was some leaked screenshots this week that I don't know if they're real or not, though, but it's even looking a bit like Chrome.
You know, it's interesting to me. On the one hand, I don't know. Somebody that cares about web standards, there's the thing of like, hey, it's good to have multiple implementations and to have like, you know, the whole monoculture of everything being Chrome-based.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, it's an open source project and people can work together and fix it. On the other hand, it's like if the company controlling Chrome push it in a direction, that's where the whole web goes.
Right. Yeah, and they're bullies too.
Yeah, I worry about stuff even like there's been this thing for a while about changing what shows up in the URL.
Mm-hmm.
Getting rid of HTTP and hiding, you know, how much of the domain name do you hide and all that. And that stuff kind of like scares me some.
So a couple comments on this. One is, you know, Microsoft's probably one of the only companies in the world that could actually say, you know what, if Google does something bad, we'll just fork it. Right. Like almost no companies have the resources to do that. But Microsoft is one of them. But one thing I've not seen is like, is it only the rendering engine that they're taking, and are they keeping their own JavaScript engine, or is it the whole thing, or has that been announced?
I don't know.
I am not sure either. Although when it comes to the JavaScript engine, I'm pretty sure I saw some heated conversations from people that had dependencies on Chakra, which was Edge's JavaScript engine. They were very worried that what does this mean for that particular product? And there were Microsoft people speaking in defense of it, saying, oh, don't worry, it's not going away. We're going to continue to enhance it. There's internal projects that use this engine. So, and that to me sounded like, wow, they're taking it all. They're taking V8 too.
Interesting. Because they did all this like stuff to make Chakra cross platform. And then they were like trying to get Node community to support hosting Node on top of Chakra instead of V8 or in addition to V8.
Yeah.
So I didn't know whether like all that stuff was just sort of gone now because they're going to adopt V8 or not.
Yeah. You know, on the one hand, I was kind of like, oh no. And then on the other, it's like, you know, what, from a business perspective, what real business sense does it make for Microsoft to push too hard on building their own HTML rendering engine? Like,
I just wish they had gone with Firefox. Like just because that would, you know, keep a healthy competition in the rendering space. And Firefox is like, you know, under-resourced but still like really impressive. And I mean, I actually know developers who develop full-time on Firefox. I think development tools are really great. And so that would have been like very interesting to me if they had thrown their weight behind whatever the Firefox's rendering engine is.
Yeah, I've actually switched over to Firefox in the wake of all that news.
Mm-hmm.
I have it installed on like 2 PCs, a couple of laptops, the iPad, iPhones, everywhere now.
I've been using it a lot more lately too. It's not, I jump between different browsers, but I found that the one thing I worried about was like, well, I have 90 different Chrome extensions. What's going to happen? And I found a lot of the stuff I used extensions for in Chrome were like built into Firefox. So the other things, it was like pretty easy to find an extension for.
Yep.
But fast, good developer tools. A lot of stuff to like about it. I was surprised because I've used Firefox over years and it's always felt like an open source science project kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was like, whoa, no, this actually works. You know, I will confess that I am a tab abuser which may not be news, but I often will declare bankruptcy on a browser by switching browsers for a bit. And so I'm scared to open up Firefox because I think I have 90 tabs open there. And I need to
That leads me to a natural question here, which is, so I use Safari as my primary browser. Although I still use Chrome for development stuff just because the Chrome development tools have always fit me better than the Safari development tools. I don't know if that's just my own personal mental limitations, but I have a really hard time getting past that. But the thing that kills me about Safari is once you get to a certain number of open tabs, the UI starts being really laggy. I'll go and I'll open a tab and it'll take 10 seconds to open, or, you know, even you'll close a tab and then you'll get the beach ball spinning for, you know, 10 seconds. It's super annoying. How is Firefox in that regard?
It worked pretty well for me. It worked well enough for me that I abused it by opening too many tabs. So so they have this new thing, and I'm not an expert here, but they have this quantum thing. There's like, it's the latest, I was running the latest release of it, and like it worked well. So I have to be fair in comparing, because it was faster than Chrome for me, but I have 90 extensions on Chrome. But then again, I had 90 extensions on Chrome because some stuff that you would maybe hope would be standard wasn't. So, yeah.
Yeah, I would say overall it hasn't been any worse than Chrome.
Yep. So this is interesting. I just reopened Firefox and it says, would you like to refresh by removing your add-ons and customizations and restoring your browser settings to defaults? I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll just play around with it some more.
Yeah. Yeah. So, overall, like, I was impressed with it. I've been pretty, pretty quick.
The other thing is that Safari, the reason I switched back from Chrome to Safari was, it's just better battery life. Chrome is a serious battery hog. And I don't know how Firefox does in that regard. That would be the other interesting question.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing for a while when Chrome was like, when Edge, you know, was kind of saying like, here's our competitive advantages. And one was battery life. Like, they were really pushing that, and they were like showing advertisements of, here's how much battery life, here's save your battery by using Edge. So I don't know. And then I remember some back and forth too about like, well, you're, being unfair at the platform level and whatever.
It is the kind of thing that I can easily see like the open source world not taking it seriously. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Yeah. Because as for a lot of reasons, but one is with open source world, it's easier for a product to say, this is a pillar. This is something we are like, for our next release or over time, we're going to continue to make better and track it and all that. Whereas if you have an open source project with a bunch of different semi-random people, then it's maybe not something that will get pushed.
Right. And even like, Safari only has to run on one platform, right? It may be that, improving things on platform A actually makes things worse on platform B. So, it could be some trade-offs there.
Yeah. I have to say, like, it does really feel to me like if I ever run into a problem with rendering or with browser standards or anymore, it always feels like Safari is the, like, and I guess some of it comes from like different, like then Safari will have other features that they're pushing that nobody else is using. But Safari seems like, I know it's like a thing, but Safari really does feel like the IE to me now. it's like always the one that's like, oh, I'd love to use this. Yeah, that's the one browser that doesn't support it. And I guess it really will be that way now with Edge moving to Chromium. That's like everybody's going to be that. And then there's Safari. And Safari, like, especially by the benefit of they get to pick whatever they want to ship on iPhone and nobody else, you can't use another browser on iPhone, right? So,
well, no, we can't use another rendering engine.
Apple really can just make a unilateral decision of whatever they want to ship in Safari, and they have enough market share that, like, that's what they do. That's not a happy ending to a show.
No, I could really bum things out with a quick story, though.
Let's hear it.
So I walk out of my bedroom this morning, and keep in mind it's freezing where I live, so the heat, the furnace was on. But I walk out of the bedroom and it's just, whew, I am hit by this boiling hot air that is just so humid and it's horrible. I'm like, what on earth is going on here? I was afraid that a door had gotten open or something, and all this cold air was coming in downstairs and hitting the thermostat, and it was turning the furnace on. But I go downstairs and start checking around, and no, everything looks normal. The thermostat does say that the house is 80 degrees. It's set to keep it at like 69 or something, but it says it's currently 80, which is like 27 Celsius, I guess. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what's wrong with my furnace that is just running and pumping out all this heat? It was horrible. So I spent some time troubleshooting this and essentially reboot the thermostat, because I had bought this. It wasn't a Nest, but it was some smart thermostat that's Wi-Fi connected and all that stuff. But basically pull it out of the wall, disconnect the power, put it back in, everything's normal. Like, phew, that's good. But then I read these headlines this morning about this Triton malware. Have you heard of this? It's apparently malware that specifically targets safety systems. And so people are going nuts because it's like shutting down pressure release valves and all these mechanisms that are inside of plants to keep things from blowing up. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what if my thermostat has malware? What if that got to me somehow? How do I prevent this? So now I'm like thinking about, maybe I should buy a commercial grade router and have a private network just for my house. And I was spiraling out of control. And then at some point I just said, screw it. Furnace ran all night. Didn't hurt anything.
But it was just crappy buggy software, basically.
Yeah, crappy buggy software. And, you know, life was easier when you had thermostats with like springs and stuff inside of them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know people have been setting up like Pi Hole and stuff like that, right? These different kind of routers to like securities. Or those are more about like getting rid of adverts, but like,
And that's the thing. I mean, when I look at it, when I really start thinking about it, it's like, do I really trust this thermostat? Because we all know that these little devices that people crank out and try to minimize costs on, there's just not going to be a lot of defense in depth compared to, let's say, a browser or an operating system or something that millions of people use. So they kind of started to worry me.
Yeah, and then there's weird things too. Like, I forget, there's a story with the irons in a hotel chain that were Chinese intelligence or something. Basically, they like made sure they were the lowest bidder, and these clothing irons all had like recording gear inside them. And but then the interesting thing with that is, okay, like, so over time there's these different, you know, malware or listening, or like, you know, maybe there is something that's designed to shut down some control chips in factory automation. But then what if that gets out and then starts affecting thermostats, or, you know,
I think it's the topic, good topic for a show.
You're right.
Yes, the internet of crappy things.
That is
a good
idea.
Tune in for our next show where we talk about, can your dishwasher kill you?
Yeah, and recommend some guests we should have on to talk about that too.
Yes.
All right. Well, I think that is about time for some drums. What do y'all think?
Go for it.
Bring on the drums.
All right. High fives, everyone.